Grab your popcorn and snacks. Find a comfy spot, take a seat or lie down, and let me transport you to a place of fantasy, ghost stories, ancient legends, odd creatures, alien encounters, and other magical topics. You may even decide to join the conversation. From faraway lands to your own backyard, with a small dash of pixie dust, turn out the lights and open your minds. The journey...
Okay. Hey everybody, how you doing? Looks like Restream's having some technical difficulties. Let me click out of something really quick here. Okay. My name is Charlotte. I'm going to be your host for the next hour. I'm also the owner of the California Haunts Paranormal Investigation Team based out of Sacramento, California. We are 45 strong up and down the state, which means if you think you have a paranormal issue, we can help you. It might take us a couple days to get to you. California is huge. It's a huge state. But we will get to you. The best way to find us is just check us out on social media. We're everywhere. You name it, we're there. Okay, well, I got plans tonight. I want to update everybody on that. After this show at 7:30 p.m. Pacific, I will be back on the air with you guys. And we're going to be celebrating some Christmas tonight. We're going to be building a Santa Lego tonight and having a nice little chat. And it should be pretty fun, okay? I'm going to have all three networks going at once. I'll have TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube going at once for this build, so nobody gets left out or anything. So be sure to get your hot cocoa going and stuff, and you guys can talk to me over the chat. And we can discuss holiday things or whatever you want to talk about, all right? Okay, my guest tonight, I've been following him for a couple of years over on Instagram. I am very honored by him. You guys all know how much I love my animals. I adore my animals, you know, and I find it disheartening when people mistreat them or decide they don't want one and they toss them out. Those stories about, you know, people tossing animals out in the woods. Go ahead and survive, especially if it's a German Shepherd. Oh, you're a shepherd. You're good. You're like a wolf. Go, you know. It's very heartbreaking for me to see that kind of thing. It's heartbreaking for me to hear from my real estate friends that people will just ditch their animals in the house, too. Okay? The gentleman I'm going to have on does some incredible stuff and some very sweet things. Plus, he's done a lot of study on death. So we're going to talk to him about not only animals, but we're going to talk to him about humans. Because he's gone to different countries and studied death customs there as well. You know, not all the countries are like us when someone passes away. So we'll ask him about that tonight as well. But he does go around. He goes through the desert. If he's on the freeway or he's on some road and he sees an animal that has either been dumped on the side of the road or run over, and he always does something special for the animal. And this is what attracted me to follow him on Instagram, because it just got me right, got all the feels for me. All right. His name is Paul Koudineris. Let's hope I got his name right. And I'm going to bring him on right now. He can tell you about himself, and then we'll take it from there. And he can tell you some of these really cool stories, because he is also a photographer, and so he does get great art of this stuff. Some great art he's got going. So here we go. Let me get him on.
Hi, Charlotte. How are you?
Good. It's great to meet you, finally.
Well, pleasure's mine.
I've been following you for a while on Instagram, and I love your work. I love what you do.
I appreciate that, and I am very excited to talk to your audience tonight.
What got you into this?
Got me into which? The animals, into death, or all of it?
All of it.
Well, I have a PhD in art history from UCLA, and you're familiar with what I've been doing. It's not standard art historical practice at all. You know, I'm not out there studying Rembrandt. I'm rescuing dogs off the side of the road and holding roadside funerals and visiting countries and writing about death. And I just wrote an entire book about pet cemeteries. At UCLA, I was probably kind of the Fox Mulder of the art history department. You know, everyone else was doing a connoisseurship, and I was out there studying, you know, woodblock prints of werewolves and stuff. So I was always kind of working on this fringe material all through grad school. When I finished that degree, I was in Europe and in a church in the Czech Republic, not the church you think, completely different church that happened to have a room filled with bones, not a famous one at all, but an absolutely lovely one, very spectacular, that had once been a part of the village's spiritual life. And I came up, I came up from underground. It's like, how come one of these places is famous here and this one's not? And I started doing some research, finding all these places. And I realized that there are a lot of things that were once important spiritually at one time, and we have kind of pushed them to the margins because we're uncomfortable with them. And that's what got me involved in the whole death studies thing. You know, it's like studying this visual culture and this anthropology of death. We're uncomfortable, so we pushed it away. That doesn't mean it was not an important part of visual culture. And then the animal stuff, I've always loved them. You know, I wrote an entire book. Well, technically, my cat wrote it. It was written under my cat's name as a narrator. I wrote an entire history of domestic felines. So the pet cemetery stuff, it's kind of right there in the middle, isn't it? If you did the Venn diagram, you know, animals and death studies, you wind up at pet cemeteries.
Absolutely. When you look at this, and I know you find animals sometimes in the desert, you find them on the side of the road. Does it break your heart to see them like that?
Well, absolutely. And what Charlotte's referring to is I've been working on a photo series for a long time where it started when I was living in Joshua Tree and so many animals were dumped and they'd wind up dying out in the desert. And I started driving around with funeral shrouds and flowers and so forth and other things in order to pay some kind of fitting tribute to them, because I believe it's gospel for me. I believe that animals that have given love, first of all, I believe that all things deserve a death with dignity. They all deserve a good death, all the creatures. And animals that have given love deserve nothing less than that returned to them at the time of passing. And so I wanted to create a good death for these animals that I found in the desert. So, of course, it breaks my heart, you know, whether it was a known pet or just a coyote pup that got run over. It breaks my heart always.
I tell you, it gets me all the feels, you know, when I see these photos that you take of these animals. And You're such a lovely man for doing it.
Oh, I appreciate that. It's not easy. It's not, you know, the first time this occurred to me was I found this beautiful coyote out on Old Woman Springs Road that had been hit by a car. Just beautiful, beautiful creature. Absolutely lovely. And I pulled over for it. And I just looked at that body that had been this, you know, a beautiful living creature just what an hour before. That there is no memory we will preserve no memory of this animal, you know, from this time forward. And it broke my heart, you know. It's like, why, you know, is there some way to memorialize these creatures? And it was from that coyote that the photo started.
How many animals do you think you've memorialized that way over the years?
Hundreds, because they don't all wind up online. The thing that people don't understand is a lot of those pictures don't wind up online because, you know, it's funny. I get people who accuse me of being ghoulish or something because I'm leaving flowers and wrapping a dead animal. In those photos, you will see absolutely no gore. I always hide the gore because I want them to be preserved and remembered for their earthly beauty. And, you know, but I stop for all kinds of others. I just don't post those pictures. Those people who think I'm ghoulish have no idea. Because if I wanted to be ghoulish, believe me, I could take photos that would make you vomit instantly.
Oh, absolutely. I've seen dogs. I've seen animals run over by cars. It's not a pretty sight.
No, it's not
a pretty sight at all. No. Now, let's talk about pet memorials a little bit, because that's what you're doing with that. But as far as, like, a regular person like me, you know, what is the thing the connection that humans have with pets to make them want to do this, to go to those pet cemeteries and build, you know, and have these memorials built?
Well, we have a very different relationship with animals than we do with people, obviously. I had a lot of people, so I had been working on this book about pet cemeteries, Faithful Unto Death, for over a decade. And you know, in interviewing people and talking to people about this. And in the process, I worked as a grief counselor for people whose pets have died, as a volunteer grief counselor for a year. The thing that I always heard people say is like, you know, why does it hurt? Why does this hurt so much? Why does this feel even worse than when my uncle or my brother died or something? It's not really that the pain is worse. It's that it's different. And it's different in a way that's very irreconcilable to us because we have such a different relationship with pets. You know, another person is always a discrete individual. We will always recognize their individuality first and foremost as a discrete person. A pet becomes a part of us. They become this mirror image of our soul. You know, they become a piece of our psyche. And so when they die, it's like a piece of you has died as well. So there's that part of it. There's this feeling of the death of the innocence. You know, it's like a human being can demonstrably sin and do many, many things to offend us. An animal has usually done none of those things. So there's this feeling that there's always a feeling with a pet that their death is somehow very, very unjust. And when it comes to animals versus people, we have an entire infrastructure built up socially to provide closure for the death of a human being. You know, it's like the funeral, the wake, all this stuff that we go through. And that's not really for the dead. It's for the living. We don't have that when it comes to animals. And so when a pet dies, it's kind of like, you know, pat on the back. Okay, well, go back to work. And sorry about the dog, buddy. And good luck with it. You know, it's like we don't have a built-in healing system for animals. So there are several different factors that I think make it so difficult when an animal dies.
I think as we grow older, too, I mean, I remember as a kid, you know, because I was raised around dogs and everyone would die. My dad would go to the pound, bring another one in. You're happy because you're a kid. You don't know any better. But as you get older, you have that connection with that certain personality that dog was. So it's harder to have another pet brought in.
I agree with you. It's funny because I was, what was it, last week, I think it was, I was on the radio show Coast to Coast, and the host, George, had said to me, you know, and it must be a lot more difficult for children when the animal dies. And I contradicted him. I said, no, George, I don't think it is. And I think you're right, Charlotte. I think it's much more difficult for the adults because we have a much greater context for understanding death. And there is this kind of, maybe we could call it survivor guilt when, you know, when you are an adult responsible pet owner and your animal dies, there's kind of like, oh, I shouldn't really bring in another dog for fear of offending Buddy or offending what Buddy had meant to me. And I've always said that is that, you know, when I was working as an animal grief counselor, I always told people, no, that's untrue. You need to give yourself time for closure, obviously, before you get another pet. It will never be the same as with Buddy or Fido, but there's another dog or cat waiting to start another adventure with you in life that will be different, but it will be rewarding. You've heard of the Rainbow Bridge, right? The famous
Right.
So I am the first person ever to track down the actual author of the Rainbow Bridge. You know, that has always been anonymous. No one ever knew who wrote that. I found her. She was a Scottish, she was at the time, she wrote it in the 1950s. It's that old. She was a Scottish teenager who wrote it in the 1950s when her dog died. I got the first interview that she ever gave when I was working on this book about the Rainbow Bridge. And so at the end of this interview, I said to her, so Edna, you know, I have one final question for you. What is your advice to someone whose pet has died? Because she wrote the Rainbow Bridge. And she, you know, she was kind of taken aback. She's like, well, you know, who am I to say what other people should do? And I said, well, you're the expert, aren't you? She's like, in what way? I was like, you wrote the Rainbow Bridge, right? The greatest piece of mourning literature, not just animal mourning literature, the greatest piece of mourning literature ever. You are the expert, right? And she looked at me. She's like, okay, well, if I'm the expert, here's my advice. Get another dog. Immediately without hesitation, because that's what she's always done. Because I do think, I've always cautioned people a bit against that. Don't be afraid to get another. You're not offending that memory of that previous pet. That pet didn't want you to be lonely. That pet loved you.
Yeah. It's just a shame they don't live longer. That's what's sad about it. You know, like I have my three-year, I had this one I got two years ago. She's five now. And now the gray hair is starting to come in. You know, and so I feel bad when I look at her because it's like, okay, you're getting up there again, and here we go again. You know,
it's a shame that we don't live longer too. It's you know, you play the game with the cards you're dealt.
Yeah. So when people go into, a lot of people will go to extreme measures to honor their pets. I mean, there are pet cemeteries that have areas just like a regular cemetery. I mean, they've got, you know, the big tombstones and all that stuff.
Sure. Well, something I should point out about the pet cemeteries, because they're not as big a deal nowadays as they were. Nowadays, more people cremate. You have to understand that the heyday of the pet cemeteries was in the late 19th and early part of the 20th centuries, because we, you know, culturally, cremation has a history too.
Right.
And, you know, it was very popular in the pagan world. We kind of stopped doing it for a long time because the Christians didn't really like it. And it only starts to become popular even for people at the end of the 19th century. So for pets, it was out of the question. It was nearly impossible to get a pet cremated. So most of the stuff that I study in that book, you know, the bigger impressive monuments for pets, it's older stuff now because, as I said, you know, nowadays more people cremate than anything. But I like the cemetery. I like the idea of having a gravesite to return to. And you're right that some people have made fantastic monuments for their pets. But the thing that really appeals to me about this topic is, you know, there is this now universal truth that if you have loved an animal, if you've truly loved it, it does deserve this death with dignity. We've come to accept that as this gospel. But wherever you go through the world, because I had traveled from country to country to country, continent to continent, studying how people memorialize their pets, you will find that same truth. You'll find that same idea, but you'll find all these different variations. And that's what I loved about it, seeing the different regional variations to come to this, you know, same point. Because not all pet cemeteries look like a little miniature version of a human cemetery. There was this beautiful cemetery in Helsinki, one of my favorites in Finland. It's out in the woods, and it's got, you know, it's in the middle of the forest. You've got these hand-painted wooden blocks with hand-painted pictures of the animal and hand-inscribed, hand-inscribed messages from the owners. In Juarez, Mexico, their pet cemetery, same tradition of hand painting, but a completely different landscape, you know, desert landscape and just rocks mm-hmm. sitting along the ground with hand painted portraits of the pets and hand painted images, hand painted messages from the owners. And I love that. It's one of the things I love about the pet cemeteries is not how they replicate human cemeteries, but how they're different and how that difference to me is so much more expressive and honest and intimate.
Interesting. Now, speaking of your travels around the world, you have some interesting places that you have gone. And just recently, you had that pictorial of the family that was redressing the little girl.
Sure.
Let's talk about those kind of customs.
So prior to the writing the cat book and writing the pet cemetery book, I had written three books that explore different elements of the visual culture of death. And they're as much anthropological as they are historical. One of them was about European charnel houses. There was another one about Baroque bejeweled skeletons. And one was a more global survey. And one of my favorite practices, the one you referred to, is called Manene. And it's in Indonesia. It's only in Tanatoraja, which is a certain section, a district of the island of Sulawesi. And it's become kind of famous online. Have you ever seen pictures of people in Indonesia where they're standing next to their mummified relatives, you know, or they're cleaning them off or they're redressing them? So the Manene is the mummy festival in Tanatoraja, and they don't just, you know, dump their dead in a ditch and, you know, a pit or a hole and bury them over and stick a tombstone on it. They keep them in a family crypt. And whenever the family feel, the Manene is usually in August. There's no set date because it depends on when the crops come in. Because when the crops come in, which is usually in October, then they have free time to deal with the dead and, you know, perform some form of ancestor veneration. And so whenever the family feels like it's the right year for it, they'll take those dead, whichever ones they want to see, you know, again, whichever they feel need their attention, they'll take those dead people, those mummies out of the family crypt, and they will meticulously clean them off, you know, they'll give them new clothes and they will tend them. And, you know, I think it's absolutely beautiful because the dead are not forgotten. They're not kicked out of the social circle. They're not kicked out of the family circle in the process of redressing them. You know, they will talk to them. They'll tell them about village life. Everybody will come over. And it's not what people think. It's not some, you know, like somber funereal thing. Like people are joking around. They're putting little, you know, the kids will come and they'll put funny hats on grandpa and take selfies with them and stuff. And because the dead are not really gone in a scenario like that, they're still a part of the family unit. They're just a silent part of the family unit. The first time I went to Taraja, I had a guide that I had hired to drive me around the island and find some of these places for me. And we had gone to visit a home where a family had found in a cave. They said they had heard a voice calling to them, They didn't know what it was or where it was coming from. And so they went out into the woods and they found in this cave a mummy of a little girl. They had no idea who she was, no idea where she came from or how she got there. They just found this mummified little girl in a cave. And so they took this girl in and they kind of adopted her as their mummified daughter, you know, one of their family unit, their dead. And they kept her mummy in their home. And, you know, they kept her displayed and they would, you know, dress her nicely and they'd keep her displayed in this little box. And so we went to visit this family and I interviewed the family and I talked to them about that mummy and the discovery of her and what she meant to them as kind of their surrogate daughter. And as we were leaving, I said to my guide, I said, you know, is it at all unusual to keep a mummy in the house, like in the house itself, to keep a mummy in there with you? And he thought about it. He's like, well, no, not to me, because when I was a kid, my brother and I slept in the same bed as my grandfather's mummy because there was really no place to put him. And so every night, we'd lay him in the bed and we'd put his pajamas on him and lay him in the bed. And then in the morning, we'd stand him up and we'd take his pajamas off and put his day clothes on and, you know, just stand him in the corner. And, you know, even for me, who thought he's hurt at all, that was a surprise, you know, that you don't hear that story every day. And I said to him, I was like, okay, but why? And he said, you know, and it was the stupidest thing I could have asked because the answer was obvious. And he gave me the answer immediately. He was like, well, because we loved him. That's why. Because we loved him. He's part of the family.
Well, when you look back through the history, even for the United States, back in the 1800s, or early 1900s, I mean, the bodies came home. The bodies were here for a week, 2 weeks on ice or whatever. And people actually had their parties around them and everything. But that's changed. Like again, like you say, things evolve and people's attitudes change and all that changed. But I mean, even if you look at Lisa Marie Presley recently with her book, she talks about having her son home for a month or 2 months after he passed.
Yeah. And it's, you know, if you go back into European history, you'll find that there are practices that are actually really similar to what I was seeing in Indonesia. So for instance, in Sicily, the largest collection of in situ mummies in the world is not in Egypt or the Atacama Desert or some exotic place. It's in Palermo, Sicily. Underneath the Capuchin Monastery there, there's over 4,000 mummies down there. And it's all mummified villagers. And every year on All Souls Day, the family would come down there, they'd change their clothes, they'd talk to them, they'd tell them about a family life, essentially exactly what was going on in Indonesia that makes so many Americans think that these people are out of their minds or perverse.
Right.
You know, it's part of European history. You know, I like to compare it to the, you know, because, okay, so what happened is, especially around the early 20th century, we started changing everything in Western culture. And we started, you know, making this ethnographic projection that everybody should somehow be doing it like us without realizing that if you look at the entire flow of history, and if you look cross-culturally, you'll find that this closeness with death is normal. It's actually the normal human relationship. We're the weirdos who changed it. Right. We're the weird ones, not these people in Indonesia, not these people in Palermo, Sicily in, you know, 1750. They were actually doing something that people had been doing for a long time. We're the weird ones. And, you know, when you think about, say, like Norman Bates, you know, it's like, well, okay, we'll leave out the murder part because that's a little bit of a nasty word.
Right.
But this idea that, you know, he's preserving his mother's mummy and tending her, when Psycho comes out, by that time, there's only one solution. This man has to be certifiably insane. And he gets locked, you know, he's locked up at the end of the movie. He is certifiably insane. And the biggest proof that he's certifiably insane is that, you know, he's still tending his dead mother and he's got the mummy there. Well, depending on the culture you're in and depending on the time period, actually doing that might just make you a model son.
Absolutely. I was also thinking about earlier history of the United States. I think it's Victorian times when people used to go and have picnics.
Sure.
They'd have picnics at cemeteries.
Sure. As I said, this closeness with death was typical. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't always showy, like dragging mummies around and so forth. In Roman times, for instance, they would often keep ancestor busts in the closet. And the ancestor bust was like a locus for the spirit. And they might have, you know, a dinner and like a family dinner. They'd set the ancestor busts around to symbolize all the ancestors being there. So it wasn't always, you know, this, you know, it didn't involve always this flamboyant display of bones or mummies or so forth. But it was always there. In Bolivia, there's a current practice that I went to this when I was working on the death stuff. I went to this. It's on November 8th. It's called the Fiesta de los Nietitas. I went to this for like 12 years in a row. Like I knew everybody down there. And it's this big festival of people who they're Aymara, meaning they're indigenous, right? They're indigenous people, the Altiplano. And they keep skulls in their homes. And some people, I've gone to homes where they've got like, you know, 90 or 100 skulls in there. Some of these people really have a huge collection. And they believe that, you know, the spirit works through the skull and this skull helps them in their daily life. You know, most people who have it have only one, but some people have a lot. And every November 8th, they'll have this big party down at the cemetery. Well, they'll take all the skulls down to the cemetery to kind of recharge their powers and thank the dead for all that they do for the living. And we're not talking about a small festival. We're talking about, you know, 5,000 people coming down with skulls. It's the biggest skull festival in the world. And it's a completely contemporary thing. It goes on until this day. It's just not something you hear about very often because, like I said, our relationship with death has changed.
Are people willing, because you just said you know people down there, but like in these smaller countries, are people willing to talk to you and show you what they're doing? Or are they kind of secretive about it?
No, there's a lot of things that go into that. You know, first of all, it's going to depend on your attitude when approaching. It's going to depend on what your objectives seem to be. It's funny because I was in the rural Czech Republic once, and I was looking for one of my books, I was looking for more small bone rooms. This tiny, tiny little village that I knew had one somewhere. And I go to the village. I had a guy to help me translate because they don't speak Czech. And we had to track down the priest. And, you know, we told him, it's like, we tried to explain to him, hey, he wants to see the bone altar. And, you know, the ossuary in the church, is that okay? And the priest seemed surprised because, you know, nobody even knows it's there. It's not for tourists. It's for locals. And he seemed surprised. He said, yeah, sure, I'll show him. He looks at me. He's like, but, you know, he's not Czech. Where's this guy from? And the guy explained to him, it's like, oh, he's from Los Angeles. And the priest was like, Hollywood? It's like, yeah. He's like, you're coming from Hollywood to here to see this? It's like, no, trust me, you've got something we need to learn about in Los Angeles. Because oftentimes in those small villages, that's where traditions have continued without failing. Right. And that's what's important. You know, they've withstood the test of time. The first time I went down to Bolivia to participate in the Skull Festival, I had done a lot of research, which was a lot harder then, because, you know, we're talking about more than a decade ago. It was a lot harder to do this research, but I was able to find some addresses for people who had large collections, and I wrote to them in advance to explain, you know, who I was and what I was doing and the study that I was doing that I wanted to come down. And I had found one lady's skull collection because it mentioned her. Her name was Doña Ana, and she's a Yatiri, which is local, like we translate it as a shaman. And there was an article about her in the paper, and it called her house a Templo de Muerte, you know, a temple of death, because she had all these skulls in there. And I had written to her and said, you know, it's like, I'm from the United States, I want to come down and do this and this. And, you know, I really want to see and take photos of the Templo de Muerte, this temple of death. And when I get to her house, I was able to track down her address and to get to her house and explain that I'm the person who wrote the letter, because she never wrote back. She looked at me very, very angrily. And she's like, I got your letter. My house is not a temple of death. My house is a temple of life. And I was like, okay, I apologize. You know, this is what they said in the newspaper. She's like, that's because the newspaper doesn't understand. Do you want to learn the truth? I was like, that's why I'm here. And so then it was okay, because I was willing to understand, you know, and look at it. You have to kind of, you know, very long answer to your question. You know, what are their attitudes? Right. It depends. It depends on your objectives. It depends if you're going down there with respect and you're willing to learn. And it depends on how you present yourself. I had presented myself that first time in Bolivia. I had presented myself poorly because I had looked at what locals were saying and kind of fallen for, you know, fallen for the stereotype. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But she was willing to teach me anyway because I told her I wanted to learn.
Fascinating. Absolutely incredible. Now, you said earlier that there's people that like what you do, and then, of course, there's going to be people that don't like what you do. What types of comments have you gotten over the years with this stuff?
That's true with anything, right? I always tell people, you know, don't take online chatter too seriously. You got 99 people who say you're doing a good job, and one guy starts insulting you. I mean, that's 1%. You've just got 99%. You're doing well. You got to block that out. Yeah. I tend to be very protective of some things, especially those photos from, say, Indonesia that show a family dressing their child, you know. So I tend to be very vigilant about that. If anyone comes on and says, you know, it's like, hey, these people are out of their minds, you know, this is disgusting and grotesque, and, you know, I'll cut those comments immediately. Because we have to respect the family. When it comes to my own work and, you know, going around and providing memorials for, you know, animals in the desert and so forth. Mm-hmm. Oh, they can comment however they want. If they need a response, I'll give them one. I've had a lot of people tell me they think I'm out of my mind. They think I'm crazy. They think I'm ghoulish or something. And I'll talk to them about it. I'll try to convince them that this is done with respect. And this is done with the idea that these animals do not have a verbal or oral culture. So the only way that we can remember that this beautiful thing existed is by creating some kind of memorial to it. Some people just won't understand it. I had one guy who was very mad because I was driving around the Mojave Desert and my pictures were getting popular enough that when people were, you know, searching Mojave Desert in Instagram, they were seeing these pictures of, you know, roadside memorials to animals instead of, you know, girls hiking in Joshua Tree in tight shorts, which is what this guy wanted to see, I guess. And he made some comment. It's like, well, I think this is disgusting. It's like, why don't you just do the natural thing and dig a hole and bury them? It's like, wait a minute. That's not the natural thing. That's actually highly unnatural. Nature doesn't do that. Nature leaves them on the side of the road, which is where I'm actually leaving them, because I'm not moving where they were killed. So I thought that was a kind of funny comment, you know, to do the natural thing, which actually isn't the natural thing at all. It's a cultural thing he had become accustomed to. Nature doesn't dig graves.
Mm-hmm. I think it's wonderful too that you give them names.
It's a way I found that it's a way of personalizing them for people. It allows people to feel a little bit more emotional connection if there's a name to it rather than just an anonymous stray dog.
Have you ever, by chance, because obviously people will throw these animals out, you know, out in the desert. I mean, there's idiots, like I said in the beginning, you know, guy's got a German Shepherd. Oh, yeah, it's a wolf. You know, we could throw him out in the woods with the wolves, he'll be fine. Blah, blah, blah. You know, there's idiots like this. And have you ever somehow come in contact with somebody that recognized an animal?
Yeah, actually, well, so first of all, I should point out that not all these animals die. Like, I've managed to find a couple that were still alive and rescue them. There was one this week that was very dramatic. I saw this dog run across the road near Las Vegas out in the middle of nowhere. It was last Wednesday, and we recently saved him. I worked with a group of people and we tracked this dog for 5 days through the desert before we finally got him. And he was a bulldog who had been dumped. And of course, a very sweet dog. Like, the report from the vet is just how sweet he is and how kind he is. He really appreciates it. I have once actually gotten a message from a woman whose dog had been lost and hit by a car. And she wound up seeing my memorial for him like a year later on Instagram. And she wrote me a very beautiful message and thanked me. And she was very touched by the comments that people had made about what a beautiful dog he was and, you know, how they wished, you know, the best for him and in his afterlife journey. So she was touched by it.
Absolutely incredible. So, I mean, how often do you go out, or is it a random thing for you to be just driving around, you know, because you like to hike and you'd like to do, yep. I know you like to go through caves and stuff. And I mean, the area where you live in the desert, there's areas like that. So how often do you find these animals? Is it frequent or is it just something that happens randomly?
Well, So, you know, being an author, I don't have a 9-to-5 job. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I kind of make my own schedule. And you're right, I do like to hike. I do like to explore. My biggest hobby is just exploring abandoned places and finding weird old things out in the desert, you know, ghost towns, abandoned mines, and so forth. So I'm out a lot. In terms of the animals, you never know. I might go on a long drive without seeing a single one for 5 or 6 days, and I might, mm-hmm. you know, I might go an hour away and see four of them. You just never know.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to the different cultures and stuff, are there any particular cultures that really were eye openers for you? You know, that you went and visited.
Well, I think especially the Taurasians, because the thing that was an eye-opener for me with the Menene, with that mummy festival, was how joyous and fun it was. Because, like I said, if you look at the photos, people assume it's, you know, very somber and serious because they're with the remains of their dead. And that was kind of an eye-opener to me. It's like, well, you know, it's like, you know, death can be, I don't want to say death can be fun. That's a weird way of working.
Right.
Well, that's a weird way of wording it. But, you know, the infrastructure around tending the dead can have humor and have mirth and fun in it and be joyous instead of being somber and solemn. Mm-hmm. And that was a good learning lesson.
It's like these funerals they have over in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. With those funeral parlors that will put the person on a motorcycle. They'll put them in a boxing ring. You know.
Well, you know, there are actually a couple fun ones in the United States. I don't know if it's still, you're in California, right? You're in Sacramento.
Yeah, though. I'm in California.
Yeah, LA has one of those drive-through ones. You're familiar with those?
I've never heard of a drive-through one, no.
Yeah, LA has one. I'm not sure if it's still there because who knows what happened during the pandemic. Or maybe it did better business during the pandemic because it was a drive-through funeral parlor. But yeah, I've gone to it. I've gone to funerals for strangers there just to do the drive-through. When I used to live in LA, I live in Las Vegas now, and so they've got a big window on the side. It looks like a drive-through restaurant. They got a big window on the side, and you know the cars line up, and everybody just drives around behind this plate of glass. You've just got the body sitting there in a coffin laid out.
Wow. Well, nothing wrong with that, because when you think back to the 1800s in these small towns, a lot of the time, the OK Corral, for instance, they laid those bodies out in the store window.
Yeah. Well, the drive-through one is also, I think the inspiration for it, to be honest, the one in L.A., is a little bit different because it was, it's popular with especially gang members.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Because
I know that was at one point in time like kind of a thing, like they didn't want to all appear at a public funeral together,
right.
You know?
Right.
So it's a little bit different, but it's fascinating, you know?
Yeah, it is.
It's very American, you know? It's like, drive through wake, you know? Drive through memorial.
I'd go.
Well, like I said, I've gone to strangers' funerals. I've just pulled my car up and driven through.
Yeah. But like I said, with a culture like it is over here, you know, and then you see these places like I said, the one in Puerto Rico, you know, I know there's one, the company, like you say, there's something in the United States to do this too, that will put them in their easy chair watching TV, you know, like they're watching TV and stuff. And at first, when all this stuff started to come out, like on Facebook, people were really appalled by it. You know, there's no reason to be.
There's here's the mistake we make. When it comes to all the trappings around death.
Right.
There's no right or wrong. There's no right answer or wrong answer. There is only whatever fits that culture and makes people comfortable. The right answer is what's right for that culture. What's right for the people in Tarasha is having the family crypt and redressing their dead. That's right for them. Mm-hmm. It is wrong for the United States because we're psychologically not at a point where we can deal with that yet. What we're doing in the United States, for better or for worse, is right for our culture because that's what our culture is comfortable with. Mm-hmm. It's bad for Taraja because they think it's callous and heartless to throw someone in a hole and put dirt over them. So there's no right or wrong. And that is, I think that's part of the problem. You know, you talked about people complaining online. They love to complain because they don't, you know, they somehow think that what's right for them must be the standard way of doing things, and it's right for everybody.
Right. And Dia de los Muertos is a good example of that as well, because that's celebrating their dead, just like the Chinese or the Asians. On the cemetery over here, the Old City Cemetery, there was an area over on the stores where they would celebrate them as well.
Yeah. There's no right or wrong. There's whatever fits the culture. There's whatever people are comfortable with.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with that.
What do you think, you know, when you look at the world as a whole, which countries do you think are the ones that are more open with it than others? Obviously, you visited some of them.
Yeah. So, let me back up for a second.
Sure.
It took me like 10 years to even understand what I mean when I use the word death. Mm-hmm. Because we tend to throw it around as, you know, death is synonymous with being dead, you know, or it's synonymous with mortality. Death to me in the end, after traveling to 70 different countries and visiting all these places, death to me became not a biological state. So when I use the word death, I'm not talking about biology. I'm not talking about the failing of the body, or you want to measure the heart or the brain signals. Death to me is something abstract. It's a boundary. It is the boundary that separates two potential social groups, the living and the dead. So death is that boundary between them. And because of that, because death is an abstract, death can be in different places, in different cultures. And when I tell people that, they either understand intuitively what I mean or they just don't get it. What I mean is death, being dead, is pretty much the same anywhere in the world you are, because that's a biological state. Death, that boundary, however, is not set because it's abstract. So death in Taraja is very different than death in the United States. Death in Bolivia is very different. Death in Mexico is different. The boundary is different. And in some of these places, you know, like in the United States, the boundary tends to be, you know, it tends to be impermeable. It's this wall, you know, this Maginot wall, which you cannot pass. In other cultures, that boundary tends to be open, you know? And so there's, you know, there's a dialogue with it. You're either shutting down the dialogue with the dead, or you're opening up and allowing the dialogue with the dead. You know, backing up and saying that, the places where I think it is the most open, once again, in Taraja, absolutely for sure, with the Menene, because they are, you know, they're not just having the dialogue, they're physically handling the dead. You know, the border is very open in Mexico as well with Dia de los Muertos, although they're generally not physically handling the dead. In some places they are, which I was down in Pamuch last year, which is the one city in the Yucatan, you know, where they do the cleaning of the dead and so forth. And so they do take out all the bones and so forth. But I would say in Taraja, because the dialogue is open and they're physically handling the dead, I'd say there's no barrier at all.
I was thinking about New Orleans, too. They seem to be a little more open in the way they handle death there as well, right?
Yeah, well, we make, you know, there is a mistake, and I'm already guilty of it in talking to you, that we make when we discuss this subject, because we tend to stereotype, you know, a country or a culture as being all one thing, and it's not. You know, the United States is such a vastly big culture. That vastly big country that you will find, regional variations on how they deal with that, and even in those regions, you'll find variations. In the southwest of the United States, because we have more of an influence from not just Latin America but also from Asia. We've got maybe a very different relationship with death than you might find in, say, North Dakota.
What do you think, you know, do you think people in the United States are ever going to be okay with going back to older traditions, or you think we're just going to keep on the way we are?
Well, I don't think we're ever going back to older traditions. The question is, are we going to newer traditions that will be substantially different? It's kind of, there's kind of a pendulum that swings back and forth. How far it's going to swing in the other direction, I don't know. I think by, you know, after World War I and through World War II, and you got to remember, too, there was a lot of trauma, both for Europe and the United States, about so many people dying, that it did kind of push us away. There's something about our socioeconomic system as well that pushes us away from the openness with death, just because capitalism is involved in, you know, capitalism is a futures market, and nothing connects you to the past like death, right?
Right.
Having the death around. We will change. We are always changing. We will continue to change as we become more accepting of foreign traditions and as immigration brings more people and different cultural ideas into our country. How far we're going to change, I don't know, but we will change. We're always changing. It's just that sometimes the change, you know, is so microscopic as to be immeasurable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, things have already changed, like you were saying earlier about cremation, you know, and how they felt about it. I remember my mother being Catholic, and I remember when we decided to buy, you know, get her set up for her future eventual death. And we had a big battle over it because she wanted the big casket and everything else because she's Catholic. And then when the church went ahead and said, okay, you can cremate now.
Yeah.
I showed her the article and she goes, okay, I'm fine with it. You know, as long as the church gave permission to do it. Right. But I think it's become okay for people, like you say, with their pets. I have two of my pets here with me, you know, that I've cremated. And you know, it's becoming more and more okay for people to bring Uncle Bob home or bring Dad home and have them in the closet or wherever, you know, with the dog's ashes and all that. So people are okay with that, but like you said, they're not okay with the bones, which you can kind of see, you know.
There's a big jump because then you're coming because you know, the ashes are so intangible, and now you're talking about jumping to something that is really a tangible relic. And I think for many people, that's where they draw the line. You know, it's like when they can see with their own eyes, you know, the reality of that person. I think it's you know, the ashes are so intangible. I think it's a lot easier for them. I think it would be quite a big jump for us to have Uncle Bob's skull sitting around. Not that being said, I mean, you know, I get messages from people all the time saying, you know, you've done this death work. Do you know, my grandfather's going to die. We both agree that I should take his skull. Do you know where I can get it done? And it's like, it's really, really hard to do. The United States doesn't like that kind of thing. But there are a lot of people who want that change. A lot of them. I think inevitably we'll get a lot closer to that. But as I said, it's just a question of how long it takes that change to occur.
And there's so many wonderful. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
And also, is there some sudden spur to it? You know, is there something that happens that is dramatic that causes for people, you know, a eureka moment? It's like, hey, that thing that happened just shows us. I don't know what that would be, but that thing that just happened shows us that it would be really, really loving to have your father's skull sitting next to your bed. Is there some unexpected spur that happens?
Right. Or I was just thinking too, there's so many wonderful ways to honor them now. Like I have the thumbprint of my mother, you know, around my neck. Or you can get those rings. You can get the diamonds made.
Out
of the ashes. You know, there's so many ways to do this. So maybe people are opening up a little more to stuff, you know, to having them around them. So who knows what's going to happen? It may shift back. And like you say, it would take something to spur it. Well, who knows? Maybe someday there won't be any funeral homes. You know, something's going to happen that way, and then people have to deal with it themselves.
The problem is that the retarding element in this equation is the funeral industry, because there is so much money at stake. Those people aren't going to give up easily. Forest Lawn's not just going to say, yeah, but really culturally it's better for us not to be around running the McDonald's of funeral homes here.
Right.
You know, that's the retarding element on all of it in our society in the United States is this aspect of, you know, the monetary aspect of it. And it's going to be very, very hard. You know, the funeral homes are going to resist change. One thing that, you know, since Faithful Unto Death, the Pet Sematary book came out, I've been doing a lot of podcasts. And I did one where they wanted to talk about this idea. It's like, well, you know, can you be buried with your pets? And it's like, well, actually, you can. A lot of pet cemeteries will allow you to inhumate, not the body, because they're not allowed to do that, but ashes. They'll allow you to place a human being's ashes next to their pets in a grave at a pet cemetery. You can't do it in a human cemetery. cemetery, at least not yet, or not on a wide scale that I'm aware of. But a lot of pet cemeteries will allow that. Hartsdale in New York, for instance, will allow people to be inhumed in ash form alongside their pets in the pet cemetery. They're not allowed to advertise that service, though. Now, why wouldn't they be allowed to advertise that? What force doesn't want them to, you know, publicly advertise the fact that, hey, you know, you can be buried next to Fluffy and Fido instead of Uncle Ted?
Right. I'm glad you brought that up, because recently there was a newspaper article that I saw about that, where somebody got to be buried with their pet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can't remember what it was, but it was in the paper.
I don't know which one you're talking about, but it's something that exists, and a lot of people don't know about it. And I think they don't know about it specifically because the funeral industry, you know, the cemetery industry is big business, and they don't, I don't think they want the competition.
Yeah. I'm cool with that. I think that'd be great.
Of course you're cool with that. A lot of people would be cool with that. And that's the problem. It would cost them a lot of money instead of spending thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, you know, to have a, even a simple funeral at Forest Lawn. Maybe you're in a humed for $500 next to your favorite pets. I think a lot of people would like
that. Yeah, yeah. And that's gone up. I mean, when you talk about cremations too, if we look at cremations, how much it's gone up over the years. I know 12, 13 years ago, it was $200. You could get, you'd be cremated by your $60 urn and you're out the door. And now it's up to like $2,000-$3,000 just for that.
Is it? I didn't know. I don't know that. I don't.
Yeah. Yeah, the price has gone up for that stuff. You're right.
It's all the fire. The fire is still the same, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's all a money grab, you know. Oh yeah, you know, you go in there and they're checking off the boxes. You want this? You want this? Oh, you want to do this? And you want to have this done? Cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching.
Yeah, and it's a big guilt trip too. Yeah. You know, it's like, well, if you really loved them, you'd get the polished silver hand.
Yeah.
As if, you know, as if grandpa's sitting there, like somehow he's staring down from heaven. It's like, oh, brass handles, they don't like me.
I used to tease my family because we used to go up to like these old reenactment towns like Pollardville. Mm-hmm. And they'd have the undertaker there making pine caskets for like $30. I used to tease my mom and dad. I used to go, well, that's what's going to happen. I'm going to get you a pine one and that's the end of it. Don't you dare. You gotta get this, you gotta get that. But my mom especially always would get like saucers. Yeah, we're gonna get one of those. You know. What do you say to people, you know, people that find you on Instagram? I know the reason I found you on Instagram is because of course I'm a ghost hunter and I'm into that stuff, so obviously that's what drew me and plus the fact that you know, what you do for these animals. But what do you say to people that find you on Instagram to maybe get people to take a look at what you do?
What do I say? I don't say anything to them. I mean, I just make the posts. If they want to follow, they can. I don't. I'm not trying to draw anyone in, to be honest. Right. You know, it's like, you know, I've probably drawn in more people than I'd like to have, because every once in a while it's someone who's just really argumentative about it. And it's like, why are you following me online? There was some girl that sent me something like, I'm not making this up. It's something like 2,000 hate messages over a 6-month period. And it's like, why are you still around? Why don't you just delete my account and move on?
I understand. Yeah. How about this question? I know where you live, so I'm gonna pose I pose this question to everybody, not just you.
Okay.
You're on the strip in Vegas.
I live close to it.
Yeah, okay. You're standing on the strip in Vegas and you have a little bookstore with all your research and everything in your books. There's some other guys out there that do similar stuff to you, as you do. How do you draw people in? Because that's what they do. They hand out the little cards, right, in Vegas. How do you draw people into your store?
Oh, that's a hypothetical question. I wasn't expecting. How am I going to draw them in? You might have to give me a moment on this. Okay, you know what I got? Here, take a look at this.
Okay.
I have all the dog mannequins that used to be at the pet clothing store at Caesar's Palace. I got all
of them.
They're really nice, really high quality mannequins. What I think I'm going to do is I'm going to take all those phantom white dogs, all the dog mannequins, and dress them up as like Baroque princes and stuff. Because on Vegas Strip, I think I'm going to sell that. If it's the Vegas Strip, I think that's what I'm going to do.
That'll work. Well, it's been great. Would you like to add anything to any of this? Anything to encouragement to people about how to deal with death better or anything like that?
No, because I don't think that advice from one person. When I was working on the Pet Sematary book, like I said, part of the reason that I worked as a grief counselor was because I had read every book about animal mourning and animal grief that was written. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like any of them because it's like, who are you to tell someone else how to grieve? I don't think another person can do it. I think the thing that's healthy is finding someone who allows you a dialogue and allows you mm-hmm. through that dialogue to work through your own problems and maybe gives you bits of advice. But I don't think I'd like to advise somebody.
Okay. So how can people find you?
Just go to your local pet cemetery. I'm probably lurking in the bushes somewhere. on Instagram, HEXENKULT. I'm on Facebook. I'm not on TikTok or any of those.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't have a website anymore. I found that everyone was contacting me on social media, so the website was irrelevant.
Yeah. It's kind of like that now. There's a lot of people that don't have regular websites. They've got a Facebook page and not a website anymore.
Yeah,
because it's just pointless because you got all these other sources to be contacted on.
Right. It's not just that. The website is also an expense, not a big expense, but it's also upkeep. And if you're a guy like me who's a little bit of a Luddite and he's always out doing something, it's like, I don't know. It's like, and then you get messages from people. Hey, all the links on your website are broken.
I hear you. Thank you so much for coming on. I would love to talk to you again about all this stuff. I'm so glad I got to meet you, finally.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, you have a great holiday, okay? I'll be
in touch
with you on Instagram. All right.
Okay.
Have a good one. All right.
Bye-bye.
All right. That's great. Yeah, I've been wanting to talk to him for years. I've been following him for a long time. Okay, gang, this is it. This is the end for tonight. Friday night, Nancy Matz will be with us, and we're going to be talking about what are your dreams telling us, okay? What are our dreams telling us? So that's going to be Friday night, 5:30 p.m. Pacific. Now, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to go off for about an hour, 7:30 p.m. Pacific, okay? We'll be coming back on. I'm going to be broadcasting live tonight. I'm going to be building a Lego Santa sleigh. It was a gift given to me by somebody. I need that time to get things set up. Make sure you guys can see me clearly over there in the other room. But we're going to be doing that tonight, and we're going to be telling stories and all kinds of things. So we're just going to be a kind of kickback, relaxed night over there. And come on over, 7:30 p.m. Pacific. I will be on. Camera's ready. I'm going to be running to Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok tonight at the same time. So if you hear me make weird animal noises, that's because somebody gifted me with an animal on TikTok, because that's what I do. I make weird animal noises. So just be ready for that. But we're going to build Santa's sleigh tonight. And if I get done early, I might do some readings. So we'll see some tarot card readings. We'll see how the time goes tonight. So I will see you in about an hour. And come on in, join us, and it's going to be a fun night. Remember last year? We built gingerbread houses and stuff? Yeah, we're doing that this year. Tonight is going to be the Lego Santa. Tomorrow night, I might do readings. I might go every other night. Maybe we'll see. Or we might build the Lego tree. My friend got me a Lego Christmas tree, too. Then I have a gingerbread peanuts house to build. And then I also have, behind that, I have got a Oreo cookie train that I'm going to be building as well. So it's all for the holidays, and it's all to relax a little bit and hang out. So see you there. Okay? Have a great one, guys, and I'll see you in about an hour. We'll be right back.
Grab your popcorn and snacks. Find a comfy spot, take a seat or lie down, and let me transport you to a place of fantasy, ghost stories, ancient legends, odd creatures, alien encounters, and other magical topics. You may even decide to join the conversation. From faraway lands to your own backyard, with a small dash of pixie dust, turn out the lights and open your minds. The journey